Hi, welcome to the Interpreter Podcast. This is number 2. I'm Bill Hamblin, and I don't know why I'm doing this podcasting, because I don't know what I'm doing, but that's all you get. This is presented by Interpreter, a journal of Mormon scripture, and you can find us on Mormoninterpreter, one word, .com, Mormoninterpreter.com. Today we have for a guest Mark Wright. He is from the BYU Religion Department, a recent hire, and I'd like to welcome you to our podcast.
Thank you.
Now, why don't you give us a little background on yourself? I understand you're a California boy, is that right?
Born and raised in Long Beach, yeah.
And?
Did my undergraduate at UCLA. I got my bachelor's in anthropology in 2003 there. Went on to UC Riverside in 2004 and got my master's, and then just finished last year, 2011, with my PhD. So all my degrees are in anthropology, and my subfield of specialization has always been Mesoamerican archaeology.
So what was your dissertation about?
My dissertation was entitled A Study of Classic Maya Rulership. And initially I was just kind of looking at the concepts of kings becoming gods. But as I went through, I realized that kingship was expressed very differently from one site to the next. Linda Sheely, back in the 90s, she essentially proposed that there was one sort of meta-narrative, one meta-ritual that all kings would participate in, and they were just emphasized differently at different sites. But my research really looked at the differences at each site, and one of the things I argue is that there wasn't a meta-ritual. There was actually a different ritual, really, that was created at each site, drawing from similarities, but enough of a difference was extant that they were able to distinguish each other from their neighbors. And so it's really these minor differences that to us seem like minor differences that to them were a big deal. So it might be a different verb used to express their accession, or it might be a different piece of regalia that they receive on the day of their enthronement. But all of these just minor differences were consistent throughout a single site, but different from one site to the next. And so I argue that that was really part of a identity creation.
Do they change through time as well?
Yeah, we do see that. So like at Palenque, for example, after kind of a catastrophic reign of one ruler, we see a shift in the enthronement narrative, and it seems that they're kind of trying to reboot the dynasty and to establish a new direction for the kingship.
So if a king conquers another city, does he bring his royal investiture ceremonies with him, or does he take the ceremonies of the city he conquered? Or is there enough data on that?
There is actually, there might be an incorporation of both, where they would try to hearken to the prestige of a neighboring polity, even after conquering them, or it could just be maybe an important polity that was more distant, and they were trying to hearken under the authority, kind of you know, in the United States, you know, if you have a building with Greek columns, it's meant to represent, you know, power and authority. And so certain Maya polities would do that. They would use the regalia or the iconography of a foreign polity, especially that of Teotihuacan, to try to justify or validate their own rule.
Now, you today work at the BYU Religious Education, right?
Mm-hmm.
How long have you been there?
I've been teaching since 2007. I was initially just a part-time teacher, adjuncting, and then in 2011 to 2012, I was a full-time visiting professor, and I'm now on a tenure track.
And when did you finish your dissertation?
Last year.
So. Are you working on publication of that, or?
I'm going to parse it out into articles. I don't know if I'm going to turn the whole thing into a book.
That's easier and faster.
Yeah.
So, as a Maya expert who also teaches in the BYU Religion Department, you have some interesting insights, I expect, on the Book of Mormon and possible Mesoamerican connections. What do you teach there? Mainly Book of Mormon, or you teach other things as well?
Yeah, I've taught almost exclusively Book of Mormon. I did teach a couple of New Testament classes in 2008. Next winter I'll be teaching a Pearly Great Price class.
And knowing Maya helps you out quite a bit on the New Testament, I suspect.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
Now you both speak Maya dialect and you also read the hieroglyphics, is that right?
Yeah, and so I'm basically conversant in Yucatec Maya. I'm still learning it, I guess you could say. I'm not fluent. And then the hieroglyphs, I'm at a high intermediate level on those. So the modern language that I know is the Yucatec Mayan. There's still about, 31 Mayan languages that are spoken today. Yucatec is one of the descendant languages of the classic Maya hieroglyphs. The closest descendant is actually Chorti, which is, there's only about 2,000 speakers of Chorti over in eastern Guatemala, kind of by the Honduras border. And then up in Yucatan, where they speak Yucatec, there's still about 500,000 or so.
Now, did you learn Maya, spoken Maya on a mission or just on through classwork?
No, yeah, I served my mission in Colombia, and that's where I learned my Spanish. And then it's actually through UNC Chapel Hill. They've got a Yucatec language program.
So did you go down to Central America to study that?
Yeah, so I usually go down. I've been down a couple of times. I spent six weeks. So Chapel Hill, level one, I actually went to Chapel Hill for a couple of weeks of classroom instruction, and then the last 4 weeks were in Yucatan. And then level two, we actually spent the whole 6 weeks down there. And probably next summer or the following summer, I'll go down for level three.
That's awesome. That must be very interesting.
Yeah.
Now, as you study the Book of Mormon, you've given some papers and presentations and so forth on different things. I'd like to talk about a few of these. There's a phenomenon in ancient Mesoamerica called the Daykeepers, which I think you've given a presentation on. You haven't? Mm-hmm. Have you written on that or just a presentation?
I gave the presentation. There's a video up of it on YouTube. It is something that I'm going to be writing up. It's sort of in the queue behind a few other papers I'm working on. But yeah, what really spurred that? Well, I guess a little background. Daykeepers are essentially Maya calendar specialists. They're in charge of keeping track of the days in the Maya calendar. And so the ones, you know, at the colonial period, they've got the 260-day calendar, and each day is sort of auspicious or inauspicious. So, you know, there might be you would consult one of these daykeepers, one of these calendar priests, to decide, you know, what day to baptize your child or something like that, or to plant your crops. A friend of mine, a colleague named Bruce Love, non-LDS, he's done a lot of work with these Yucatec daykeepers, and as I was reading through some of his work, it brought to mind several things from the Book of Mormon. For example, I guess what really spurred it, there's a verse, and I'm embarrassed that I can't remember the verse offhand, where it talks about the date in the Nephite calendar. And they said it's been, you know, this many years of the reign of the judges, this many years since the sign of this or that. And it said, and that is according, as long as the reckoning is, of this man is correct. But they're placing the reckoning on a single individual. And I assume they're talking about the prophet Nephi. And the way they worded it, there was one individual that was in charge of the calendar. And that just brought to mind the fact that, you know, we have these daykeepers. And these daykeepers really are shamans or holy men. Oftentimes it's not just keeping the calendar. They also are healers. They'll have oftentimes a clear stone that they use in their divination. They believe that they're led to these clear stones. The clear stones are called zastun, which literally means light stone. And they'll hold them up to a light source, either a candle or up to the sun, and they wait for three flashes, which they say represents Father, Son, and Holy Ghost. And that's probably the influence of Catholicism coming in there. But that, of course, you know, it just sort of brings to mind the Urim and Thummim, the interpreters, as the Nephite calls them, which are these clear stones that are used for interpretation and divination. And so it's just this complex of ideas, with not only keeping the calendar, but also receiving revelation, the use of seer stones or translators. And I think there might be some interesting connection there between the Mesoamerican daykeepers.
Yeah, that's fascinating. Did you gave this at FAIR a year ago?
No, it was actually at the Expound Symposium.
Oh, that's right, the Expound Symposium. And the video is up where?
It's on YouTube. I think FAIR actually is hosting that video, so it's hosted under the FAIR.
So if you went to FAIR and looked up Mark Wright on YouTube, you
yeah.
come up Mark Wright Daykeepers, they could
Yeah, if
people
you just
could
Google Nephite Daykeepers, it should pop up.
Maybe we'll try to put a link to that on the interpreter webpage okay. where we are putting up this podcast.
Right.
Now you mentioned that these daykeepers, it reminds me of the Roman practice of the Flamen priests who also marked out the calendar and determined auspicious and inauspicious days.
Mm-hmm.
So this is not, I mean, this is a practice you see in other societies. But you associated these daykeepers with shamans.
Mm-hmm.
What are shamans? What role are they? Do they still exist in Maya culture? Mm-hmm. What role do they play in ancient society? And how do they? Do you see them in any way relating to Book of Mormon activities or prophets or something like that? Why don't you explain a little bit about that?
Yeah, so I mean, shamans are basically they're holy men. They are the men you consult for, you know, if you've got illness, you go to get healed. If you've got, you need some kind of a ritual done in your field, you know, to come dedicate or consecrate, if you want to call that, your cornfield prior to planting or at the time of harvest. And so these are basically just, they essentially act as prophets, as healers. I think that in the Book of Mormon, really, I mean, the people that we call prophets or holy men would be these shamans. Now, as far as that relates to the Book of Mormon as well, the way that a shaman is called, typically you're either born into it, and there are signs surrounding your birth, and everybody knows you're going to be a shaman, and you're raised as a shaman, or essentially you... you come down with a severe illness, and you're on your deathbed. And, you know, we might call it a near-death experience, but the soul travels out on this spirit journey. And then if they are healed, usually by another shaman or a holy man, if they are healed and they recover from this, that's a sign to them and to everyone else that they are now to become a shaman themselves. When their soul's off in the spirit journey, they're interacting with the supernatural. You know, it could be, you know, angels or demons or animal spirits or whatever it is. But the fact that they have interacted with the divine or the supernatural, when they come back from that, if they recover from that, they can now have a spiritually recognized power that they can then use to heal other people. Now, as that relates to the Book of Mormon, I think we have several times when people fall to the earth as if dead. And it seems kind of weird. And, you know, critics of the church will just say, oh, that's just Joseph Smith responding to I don't remember the terminology they use, but
the burned over district,
and the spiritual frenzy,
enthusiastic, great awakening,
right?
Stuff.
But you know, when you look at these callings, I mean, we have statuettes, dating to the pre-classic period, even down into the Olmec times, you know, in 1000 BC, where we see these people undergoing these shamanic transformations or these spirit journeys. So I think when we have these people falling to the earth as if dead, Almas is obviously the most detailed. He's down for the count. He interacts with the Lord. He even says, "Methought I saw even as Father Lehi saw, sitting upon his throne, surrounded by numberless concourses of angels." And so, I mean, he's having this very dramatic interaction with the divine.
But he's also thrust down into hell and interacts with demons,
right?
And overcomes them through divine assistance,
right? Through crying out to the Savior. But while he's in his trance, we read that his father caused that his priests should fast and pray over him. And so we've got these holy men fasting and praying on behalf of Alma. He recovers from it, and then he now has a spiritually recognized authority. That was his calling as a prophet. And that contrasts, I think, very nicely with the calling of Lehi, for example. Lehi's calling as a prophet fits in an old world paradigm. I mean, his calling is very much very similar to that of Isaiah or Ezekiel, you know, where they have this throne theophany. There's this, you know, the presence of fire and an apprehension of the prophet and all these other details. And it's a very different calling experience than that which Alma or Ammon had. Now, Ammon's an interesting character because it happens to him several times. And we might think, you know, he's just, you know, hypersensitive to the spirit. But in Mesoamerica, the more often these ritual specialists or priests or whatever you want to call them, the more often they fall into a trance, the more spiritual potency they're believed to have. And so Ammon, in some sense, may have been seen as the most spiritually potent of his brethren because of, you know, not only with Alma and his brethren, but also when he's with Lamoni a couple of times. Then later he meets up with Alma and his brethren in the wilderness, and he falls down again. I mean, it's just, he does it over and over and over, but this is really demonstrates, I think, his potency.
So do you think Lamoni is an example of this as well, his experience?
Yeah, because when he states very plainly, I have seen my Redeemer. And as soon as he arises, he begins preaching. He begins ministering, it says, to the people. And that ministration, I think, you know, has a connotation even of healing.
Now, do you see any iconographic representations of these types of practices in Mesoamerican art?
Well, one aspect of shamanic transformation, and I don't know if I call it shamanic transformation, but there's a ritual known as a deity impersonation, or deity concurrence, as it's called by some scholars. And what this is a ruler or other members of the nobility or elite class, they'll put on these masks, these carved masks. They may represent gods or animals, jaguars, things like that. But when they would put these masks on, they believed that they would literally transform into that god. And rather than impersonation, as some people have called it, deity concurrence more ably describes it, because you're not play acting as impersonation might suggest. Concurrence suggests that you're still yourself, but you are also sort of merged with whichever god you're impersonating. And so we see over and over these rulers and their courts donning these masks. And there's even a glyphic phrase the term is ubahil, but it roughly translates to the ruler receives the image of such and such a god in his bach. And that bach can mean head, but it also kind of represents, the head is representative of the entire sort of being. So it really, I mean, you could read it almost as the ruler receives the images of such and such a god in his countenance. And I think when Alma, when he's preaching to the people of Zarahemla, he's rebuking them. I mean, he rebukes them for worshiping false gods. And then he says, have you received his image in your countenances? And I think what he's saying is, look, you've been worshiping all these false gods. And he even mentions it when he's over in Gideon to the people there, that the people of Zarahemla are worshiping false gods. He says, you know, but have you received his image in your countenance? You know, rather than impersonating all these false gods, why aren't you becoming one with Christ rather than with these false gods? When he talks about having his image graven upon your countenances, these masks were literally graven that they would wear, and they were engraved by ritual specialists. And we actually have, you asked about the iconography, and we also have iconography of these masks being carved or graven. Yeah.
Do any of these masks survive?
Not that I'm aware of.
They're mainly made of wood and feathers and so forth.
Yeah, wood does not survive.
Right. What about the jade mask that's on Pakal at Palenque?
Yeah, the burial masks are a different thing. Yeah, so jade, there's a whole complex of ideology with jade, sort of being the breath of life and things like that.
So I would speculate that this is a rivalry between two different religions, mm-hmm. both saying, we want the countenance of God placed upon us. Mm-hmm. The Nephite saying it should be the countenance of God and Christ and so mm-hmm. forth. You take that countenance upon you. But the Maya were doing the same thing, only it was the countenance of their gods. And so there's a mm-hmm. there's a conflict of a shared concept, mm-hmm. but rival interpretations and rival manifestations. Is that right or wrong? Is that going too far?
In some sense, the Nephites, obviously, they have their own set of gods. They've got Father, Son, and Holy Ghost. That makes up their Godhead. One thing I explored in my dissertation is the fact that there was no single Maya pantheon. In other words, not all Maya gods were worshipped the same at sites. Every site had their own set of gods that they worshipped. And more often than not, we have a unique trio of gods at each site. So we have what we call the Palenque triad, and they have their principal three gods. You've got the Tikal triad, which are different from Palenque triad. We've got the Naranjo triad, the Caracol triad. And so each of these cities had the three gods that they propitiated. And so the Nephites, by having their three gods, Father, Son, and Holy Ghost, in a sense, they would have fit in by having their own unique triad, if that makes sense. What would have stood out is if they had just tried to copy somebody else's triad. And so I don't know that it necessarily would have been in conflict. And it really goes back to what I was saying with my dissertation, this concept of creation of identity. And your identity was wrapped very closely with the pantheon that your particular city worshipped.
Now, these gods would overlap between cities, though, right? I mean,
yeah, there was
the same god worshipped in multiple cities, but they would select different gods to be in their triad. Is that what you're saying?
Yes, and some gods are more prominent than others. So you have certain gods that really kind of unite them as the Maya people. I mean, obviously, you know, we can call them all Maya, even though they never really saw themselves as one unified people. They thought each city was a nation state unto itself. The maize god, the sun god, I mean, these are prominent at all the different sites. But again, you'd have these certain patron gods that really were unique to certain cities. So you'll see a patron god at one Maya city, and he doesn't appear anywhere else. So there's sort of a core underlying set of divinities that were propitiated to greater or lesser degree at different sites. But there are certainly individual gods or, you know, multiple gods that are only found at one site. At Copan, for example, they have these the guardians of the Acropolis, these specific gods, and they're so specific, it's almost that these gods are in charge of just one certain area of Copan, and you don't really see those guardians or those gods anywhere else.
Now, earlier we talked about the daykeepers and the fact that they marked and controlled and determined, or at least interpreted, the calendar. Mm-hmm. Did the Maya have a prophetic calendar, and is that reflected in any way in the Book of Mormon? And also, there's a lot of claims going on now that within about 4 months we're going to have the end of the world because mm-hmm. of the Maya 2012
yeah.
Prophecy.
Mm-hmm.
You want to explicate or debunk any of those ideas?
Sure. Yeah, I've got an article on Patheos.com that I wrote back in 2009 about the whole 2012 phenomenon. That basically boils down to a misinterpretation or a misreading of one particular monument in Tonina Monument 9, I think it is. And you need to keep in mind that the interpretation of Maya hieroglyphs is still a work in progress. We've got about probably 85 or 90% of them translated at this point. There's still about 15% that we struggle with. And even when we can read individual glyphs, we can, you know, sound them out. Sometimes the meaning is a little bit obscure. And it was just a few years ago that there was this misinterpretation of this one text. And they thought that it said, in, you know, on this particular date that, you know, God would descend and darkness would descend, and that would be the end of it. It doesn't say that. What the date in December is, and it's either December 21st or 23rd, depending on which correlation you use. Essentially, it will be a commemoration of a temple dedication that happened in the mid, I think, 8th century A.D. It would be the equivalent of if at the Kirtland Temple dedication in, when was that, 1836. Saying, you know, we're dedicating this temple to the Lord a mere 167 years before the close of the millennium. So they're trying to frame this temple dedication in the larger scheme of time. And so what happens in 2012, in December of this year, is sort of the completion of one cycle. But then it's the beginning of the next. It's no different than, you know, the Y2K phenomenon. Everybody's, you know, freaking out December 31st, 1999 is the end of the world. Maybe not the end of the world, but everything's just going to stop working. It's going to be chaos, you know, etc. And then January 1st happened and it was no big deal. I mean, nothing happened. So for the Maya, it's the next day would be the next day. It wasn't the end of anything other than a date on the calendar and the beginning of a new one.
So it has to do with the cyclical nature of their calendar more than a specific prophecy. Is that right?
Right, yeah. And so, I mean, when they did offer a prophecy, per se, it was more of a... It was something along the lines of, in the year 2076, I will prophesy that it will be the 300th anniversary of the United States of America. It's not much of a prophecy, right? You're just saying that on this date it will mark the passage of this many years from this earlier event, and that's essentially the bulk of it. You know, we do have oftentimes marking of they'll erect monuments anticipating or I guess you could say prophesying of an upcoming date. At some sites, we have monuments that go up every their big cycle of time was a 20-year period. We have a decimal system. We count by tens because we've got 10 fingers. The Maya use a vigesimal system, which is by 20s, and that's because they you know wore sandals and counted their toes. And that's not a joke. I mean, they really did. The word for unique or the word for man and the word for 20 is essentially the same, unique or winal. And so their system was based on 20, and then so they had their 20 year cycle. And you'd multiply that 20 times 20 is 400 years. And so, you know, we do 10 is a decade and 100 is a century. They've got the 20-year cycle, which is a katun, and the 400-year cycle, which we've nicknamed a baktun. And they would even subdivide these 20-year periods into hotuns. Ho means five, and so five-year periods. And at some sites, every 5 years, they would erect a new monument commemorating either the passage of time or saying, you know, in 5 years, it will be the 20th year of this king's reign. And so sometimes they'll anticipate a king's accession years before and prophesying that on this date, it will mark this many years since the king has acceded. And they also had a 260-day calendar. So they've got multiple calendars that they're working with. And it's an extremely complex system. But the 260-day calendar, you've got the numbers 1 through 13, the cycle with 20 named days. Kind of like we've got 7 named days, Monday through Sunday, and we cycle those with the numbers 1 through 28 or 29 or 30 or 31, depending on the day. But for them, it's always 13 numbers and 20 days. And so it's this consistent 260-day cycle. Now, all of these calendars, I think, the 260-day calendar, the 5-year cycle, the Hotun, the 20-year cycle, the 400-year cycle, I think all of these are attested to in some way, at least hinted at in the Book of Mormon. The Book of Omni, for example, when Coriantumr, it says, dwelt with him for 9 moons. That always stuck out to me. It seemed weird, like 9 moons, because everywhere else in the Book of Mormon, they talk about months. This is the only time they give a moon count. But, you know, if you do the math, 260 days is approximately 9 months. But I think to distinguish it, I think they were trying to sort of emphasize that this was a sacred event, that Coriantumr dwelt with them for one turn of the sacred calendar, and that would imbue kind of that event with a lot more significance and meaning. Or the 5-year prophecy, this Hotun, Samuel the Lamanite prophesies in 5 years the signs of his birth are going to be given. Or the 400-year we see over and over, Alma prophesies in 400 years from the time that Christ shall manifest himself, you know, the Nephites will dwindle in unbelief. Alma says this. Samuel Lamanite reiterates that. Mormon highlights that. It's been 400 years since this. And Moroni even, not only the 400 years, but in the 20 years, in Moroni 10, verse 1, he says, I would that my brethren the Lamanite should know that more than 420 years have passed away. Now, every Maya monument, virtually every Maya monument, begins with what we call a long count. And it's a count of 400 years and a count of 20 years, and then a count of years and then a count of days. But essentially, Moroni seems to be giving us almost an abbreviated long count when he says, I would that my brother and the Lamanite should know that more than 420 years. It's perfect formula for a
and that
monument.
It would be like saying over a century or something to us, because we use century as one of those long-term markers.
And
so culturally speaking, they would make perfect sense to them.
Yeah, and so I mean, anytime we write a date, you know, we write the year, you know, every time you sign a check, you put, you know, 2012 on it. And so the 2 represents periods of thousands of years, the 0 represents periods of 100 years, the 1 represents periods of 10 years, and then the 2 would be representative of periods of 2 years. And so you add them all together. But we always, I mean, we don't really think about it, but you write 2012, and that's we're marking the date going back to our sort of zero date on our calendar. And so for the Maya, their calendar, these periods of 400 years counted backwards, typically in a Maya monument, it counted back to their zero date of August 13th, 3114 BC. Some people call it a creation date. We don't really know exactly what happened on that date, but it seems to be kind of an ordering or a reordering of the cosmos. And even there seems to be maybe some local variation in the creation mythology there. But they all seem to point back to that zero date. But it's always in terms of how many periods of 400 years, how many periods of 20 years, et cetera.
Where we use centuries and decades.
Right.
Now, last question. You've studied these ancient Maya monuments and inscriptions quite a bit. Have you ever found any mention of any Book of Mormon things in those? And if not, why not?
No. I mean, there's no mention of them. I mean, primarily these Maya monuments are concerned with their own cities, their own political dealings, with their enemies and their allies. And I think the Book of Mormon, in many ways, is the same thing. I mean, it's a lineage history of the Nephites, and they're concerned with their own people. I think we can draw an example from the Copan area. Copan is in western Honduras, right near the border of Guatemala. It's a classic period site, has pre-classic antecedents. It's an early site. But the kind of the refounding of the dynasty was with a guy named Kimichiashkukmo in I think it was 421, somewhere around there. But Copan seems the ruler of Copan seems to have been descended from or related somehow to Tikal. And so there's mention of Tikal in Copan's texts, and vice versa. And Quiriguá, which is just about 55 kilometers from Copan, they often talked about Copan because Quiriguá seems to have been founded under Copan's authority. So Quiriguá talks about Copan, Copan talks about Quiriguá, they're both talking about Tikal. But between Quiriguá and Copan, there are two sites right in between them. I mean, there's probably a lot more than two, but two that we know about. One's called, we've given the name El Cafetal, and another's called El Paraíso. And they're only about a mile or two apart, each on one side of a valley. And to get from Copan to Quiriguá, you have to literally have to go in between these two sites. I mean, that's the route between Copan and Quiriguá. El Paraíso seems to be a Maya site. Architecturally, ceramics, it's all reflective of Maya civilization. But right across the valley, a mile away, and this is coexisting temporally. I mean, these sites are around at the same time, is El Cafetal, which is a non-Maya site. Different ceramics, different architecture. And they seem to have coexisted peacefully as far as we can tell. But what's interesting is that there's no mention of either of these sites in the text of Copan and Quiriguá. So literally you would have to pass by these to get to each other. And we know that Copan and Quiriguá are warring with each other often. I mean, so they're marching right past these sites. And yet there's not a single mention of it. And I think not to suggest that El Cafetal or El Paraíso are Book of Mormon sites. They're too late for that. But just to kind of illustrate that it's not uncommon to have non-Maya sites right in between Maya sites, and there's just no mention of them. And these sites we've only known about for a few years. And so there's still a lot left in the dirt. We've got maybe half of 1% excavated. And that number actually is coming from George Stewart, who is the National Geographic's Maya specialist for 50 years or so. He just retired a few years ago. There's a lot yet that we don't know.
Yeah, in fact, there's vastly more that we don't know than we do know. Uh-huh. Last question. Do you have any future research projects or directions you're planning to go?
Yeah, actually, that last thing I talked about is something that I want to explore a little bit more, looking more at the sort of non-Maya people that are living among the Maya area, what we can learn about them. A lot of them are not much of a textual history, so to speak, and just what can the dirt tell us about these non-Maya people. I'm presenting at a conference next week comparing Mesoamerican temples and what we can glean from the Book of Mormon about temple worship in the Book of Mormon. I'm doing some research for a non-LDS publication on poetics in the Mexican codices. The Mexican codices are less phonetic than the Maya ones, and basically looking at poetry really using the hieroglyphs. They would arrange their calendar glyphs. They would arrange their calendar glyphs according to poetic principles. In some instances, even chiasmus and other types of parallelism. I've got a few other papers, and I can't even remember what else I'm working on. So,
great. Well, we really appreciate you coming by to let people get to know you and hear what you're working on.
It's my pleasure.
This has been Mark Wright from BYU Religion, and I encourage you to take a religion class from him if you ever get the chance. He also, I want you to know, wore a tie to a podcast, which doesn't seem very fruitful because no one knows you're wearing a tie when you're when it's pure audio. But he is reflecting then the high standards of religious education at BYU. I, by the way, do not have a tie on. And I'm much happier than Mark Wright because of that. So thanks a lot, Mark.
You're welcome.
And we'll try to do another interpreter podcast later. So if you want to hear more and learn more about the interpreter, check out MormonInterpreter.com. Thanks a lot.
Thank you.